You know, what are we talking about today? I'll tell you what we were going to talk about. We were going to talk about intellectual property and seeds and the importance of intellectual property and patents. And then, of course, I was going to get on my high horse about the fact that, you know, we're at this intersection point of seed patents between biotechnology and seed, and we get artificially extended patent life, and it doesn't do anything besides hurt innovation in the farmers, which is my standard, you know, campaign promise to eliminate patents. The only person I've ever seen that actually took a serious interest in that other than me was Tom Vilsack. He really believed that deal. Unfortunately, I think it was me and him, and everybody was shooting at us, and he's bigger than I am, so they were really shooting at him, which, you know, wasn't a good thing. But, you know, strangely enough, Secretary Rollins was in Kansas City yesterday, which, as we're doing this, is Thursday, September 25th. She was in Kansas City, the AgriPulse Forum. And she said, somewhere I got that thing pulled, can pull it up. She actually said that, I'm looking, maybe we can edit out this part. She actually said that the Trump administration is going to vow to protect American farmers for high and volatile costs of fertilizer, seed, equipment, and other key inputs as growers grapple with a difficult agriculture economy. USDA and DOJ joined forces today, being September 25th. To ramp up oversight of farm costs and ensure competitive agriculture and food supply chains, as well as lower prices for consumers. The Agriculture and Justice Department signed an MOU, Memorandum of Understanding, outlining a joint effort to safeguard U.S. farmers and ranchers from wild price swings in fertilizer, seed, energy, equipment, and other key inputs. The Antitrust Division of DOJ will work hand-in-hand with USDA, effective immediately, to take a hard look and scrutinize competitive conditions in the agriculture marketplace, including antitrust enforcement that promises free market competition. Farmers have had enough challenges to deal with. Sky-high input prices shouldn't be one of them. That was stated and quoted by Secretary Rollins, and thank you to our good friends at AgriPulse for covering that and putting the story out there. But that is where we start the day, a new era of, you know, competition enforcement in agriculture. And welcome to Stock Talk. Play the song. All right. This morning, we're joined by Joel Cape, our good friend and attorney who's Ipsos attorney and has been around the seed industry for many, many moons and kind of knows the ins and outs of this. Joel also has done some watching and looking and working with the Department of Justice at different times over competition issues. So, you know, glad to have you here today. This is kind of an an unrehearsed discussion on the latest from Secretary Rollins. So it could be quite interesting that what we might actually tell you that we don't plan to. And then maybe we'll talk a little bit about seed patents too. And of course, I always am joined with my co-host, Catherine Friends. Hey, Kath.
Hey.
Kath. Is that new? I'm going to start calling you that because I'm just an idiot and couldn't say Kat and Catherine together. So it merged to Kath.
Again, you're one of the few people who still just call me Catherine.
Me and your dad and your husband. I'm in a group of three, right?
Yeah.
There you go. Well, you know, that's just who you are. You're just Catherine. Okay, Joel.
Yes.
So I got a text message from you this morning. You said, "Hey, man, did you hear this thing the secretary said?" And yours was actually not the first message that I got on this. I started getting them last night. And of course, I saw it probably right after she said it. So what do you think over this deal? I mean, no question. I guess to set this up, I mean, it's really getting to be the heydays at this point of discussion in the agriculture economy. That we are sitting, at this precipice. A lot of people are comparing the agriculture economy today to the agriculture economy in 1980. Catherine, you do remember that, right?
I was not born in 1980.
Exactly. You don't remember that. Joel and I do, because we lived it. The drought in 1980 was probably the reason, I need to thank the good Lord for that, probably the reason that I'm not a dairy farmer today. It was very bad then. Of course, the 80s were also when we saw, you know, the rise of the payment in kind program, because we had such a glut of grain in the marketplace and, you know, all kinds of different things. It was a very difficult time for farmers, and this is being compared to that. And I think that there is a, there's certainly a difference. I mean, then we did not have biotechnology and seed. Seed prices were in a completely different category from a price standpoint. You know, fertilizers there, which has also been incredibly volatile with the things happening in the world. And what we're seeing now in the United States is something that we really had not seen previously, which is a large number of our farm inputs around fertilizer and seed are foreign controlled, where previously we had a lot more emphasis of control in the United States. So, Joel, what are you thinking here?
I'm pretty encouraged by the look at the, you know, just consolidation in farm inputs, right? You know, the various and sundry meetings that have been going on, you've seen, like, there was a big blowout meeting over in Eastern Arkansas where the representatives attended to hear the concerns of farmers about, you know, the bad prices that they're receiving. You know, it's pretty much locked in at this point. Everybody's going to lose money, right? And I say everybody, I probably should qualify that. Corn, beans, cotton, they're going to lose money and quite a bit, right? So it's not necessarily everybody, but, you know, our major commodity crops. And so there's some representatives going on listening tours to hear concerns, complaints. But what was interesting, I heard in one of the articles I read at one of those meetings, or at least one or more of those meetings, yeah, people are complaining about, you know, not being able to sell, you know, their product abroad. We rely heavily on export markets. But some of them really, really griped about consolidation, massive consolidation in the industry. And they say, right, you can send out some aid packages and, you know, help us limp along to the next season. But until you address this consolidation issue where all the inputs are sort of been sort of combined into just this tiny little handful of you know, global competitors, you're not going to solve the problem. And I thought that was pretty fascinating. And to a certain degree, whether this is Secretary Rollins' answer to some of those concerns or not, I don't know, but it certainly does, you know, come right on the heels of some pretty loud voices in the ag community that they're concerned not just about the loss of export markets, but they're concerned about the loss of competition in the ag input space, seed, fertilizer, chem, you name it.
Well, if you look at it all in aggregate, I mean, let's face it, when you start talking about the loss of export markets, okay, that's all of a sudden your demand is dried up. So, you know, there's not as much competition out there, period. And then, but the issue of consolidation in ag chem is not, or not ag chem, in the ag markets is not new. We have been looking at this now for three solid decades across multiple areas, whether it's fertilizer and the massive collapse of companies into, you know, one. I mean, let's look at the ones that are still remaining out there. It's very few. Fertilizer prices are very high. You know, part of that is obviously global events and relations with Russia and China both. The next piece is the seed industry. The seed industry has been under consolidation literally since 1996, the year after, you know, the real entry of Roundup Ready and BT into the marketplaces. And we've seen, I mean, because I lived that in, you know, there were 11 major ag chem companies. And there were giants out there that controlled massive amounts of the soybean herbicide market, like American Cyanamid. That's a name you haven't heard in more than 20 years, because by, I guess, before 2000, they were gone. You know, they had been bought by BASF, as I recall. But that 11 companies collapsed down to six. And then ultimately, in 2017 under, you know, President Trump's first administration, collapsed down to basically 3.5, where you saw, you know, Dow and DuPont go in to form Corteva, Bayer acquire Monsanto, Syngenta, you know, be acquired by ChemChina. You know, those were the, when you look at the major companies engaged in seed, it, you know, let's face it, Monsanto and Dow, Pioneer, had always had the lion's share of the market. But when you consolidated everything back in, it really got to be interesting. And of course, that's when, you know, Monsanto becoming owned by Bayer, although the Germans are our allies, is a non-U.S. player. And likewise, even though Syngenta was a Swiss company, going over to China has certainly created a lot of angst in different quarters with, you know, state governments and federal governments taking such aim at the Chinese from that standpoint. And, you know, barring Chinese ownership from farmland in certain states. I mean, when you look at all of that together, yes, there's been collapse over decades that has happened and has resulted in this. So I'm interested, I guess, having been part of discussions in 2017 about what was going on and including discussions on the Hill with the CFIUS committee, the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States and some of those other things, really wondering what the heck they're going to do at this point. I mean, well, what is it that they actually can do? And the other side is that if we had export markets, this would still be something to be talked about. But at the same time, it probably wouldn't be that furious because it is the grain markets that are really under so much bad pressure. And you look at cattle farmers, as I was recently reminded, you know, livestock is doing very well. Cattle's at all-time high prices. And, you know, so there are those farmers that have got that hedge that are doing both grain and cattle that are doing, you know, doing okay. And cattle farmers are doing better on their livestock side. But the grain situation is as bad as anything I've ever seen in my entire life.
It's pretty dismal. You know, you mentioned earlier that this has been going on for decades. And what can USDA and DOJ actually do? I don't remember how long ago it was, but this is your point that it's been going on for a long time. They've looked at this before. There was some sort of, you know, national listening tour 3 or 4 or 5 administrations ago where USDA looked at this issue of consolidation and sort of lack of competition in agriculture. And you heard about it for a while and then just kind of faded away. You know, just there was some discussion, there was meetings, and then nothing happened. And, you know, you would like to think that something could be done, right? You'd like to think that some, you know, DOJ could step in. And truthfully, I think they can. You know, the antitrust laws are fairly broad. They not particularly well defined, but they're pretty broad and they give DOJ and FTC some pretty broad powers. I think that they could do something if they, you know, sort of really bowed up and did it. You know, they've had some success with Google, right? You know, that's one of the first big successes that DOJ has had in an antitrust case in decades. And so, you know, maybe things are starting to turn to their favor. What can they do? You know, something.
Well, let me, you know, before we go there, I mean, really and truly, what have they done with Google besides file a lawsuit? I mean, there's nothing being broken up. You know, there was all this discussion, well, Google's going to have to sell search and Google's going to have to do this. And people wonder how big search is. Well, search was big, but as Catherine has pointed out, search is being replaced by
AI.
You are absolutely right. So that's, you know, that's one of the downsides of litigation as a solution to problems. Litigation moves slow. And that case, they proved anti-competitive conduct, right? But it took so long. And by the time they got their result, you know, innovation has sort of come in, and I think the judge in his opinion, I haven't read it, but I think I've read some summaries. The judge, even in his opinion, said, you know, the problem is sort of, in some ways, been sorted out in the market because, you know, new innovations have come out. AI in particular are starting to provide the solution. Now, that really isn't happening in the ag input space.
Well, yes and no. Okay, so, I mean, fertilizer, you're correct. It's not really happening. Although we are seeing a lot of the rise, of course, now with the regen practices and looking at products that, you know, to replace nitrogen fertilizer. But when you get into potassium and phosphate, you're not seeing anything there at all. So, you know, we're not seeing a lot of opportunities there for real innovation that are going to make a change. The seed industry, you know, 8 years ago it was probably at its worst. It still was bad, you know, 4 years ago. I think when we look at competition ratios, you know, you look at a 90% competition ratio and it's 2. No, I'm sorry, I'm wrong. 90% competition ratio in corn and soybean seed is 4, which means that at 90%, 4 companies make up the seed industry. At 70%, it's a whopping 2. I mean, those are numbers that are inherently bad and look bad. But again, I think the thing that I would say here, and I think there's a problem. I think the government needs to look at it. But here's what I really got to go through. Fortitude. I've been playing a lot with the, you know, 7 Christian virtues, and fortitude being one of those. There's a thought leadership thing coming on this too, Catherine.
Good.
But fortitude. Nobody in the government's got the fortitude to do this. The DOJ certainly has not shown any inkling to have the fortitude to take on these fights. And to remind everybody, according to my good friend Val over at ChatGPT, fortitude is the strength of mind and character that enables a person to face adversity, danger, or pain with courage, resilience, and determination. DOJ's got none of that. If they did, we would have a much different situation in the country than we have right now on a lot of fronts. They absolutely do not have it. Now, my question is, can Pam Bondi convince them that, by God, we're going to do this? Or more so, can the president say, you're going to do this? I will note that they did get James Comey the other day, which I laugh at, but I mean, it's kind of like, okay, well, that's interesting. But I mean, serious, where do we go and absolutely tell the Department of Justice, okay, you understand the law better than anybody else. Where's your freaking fortitude to actually create a change?
I'm going to say that nobody wants to take on a case that they can't win. Right. And DOJ in particular is going to be, before they take on the case, they're going to be almost 99.9% certain this is going to be a win. They're just, that's where they're at. That's where they're going to move. Fortitude. Yeah. You know, I'll put it this way. If Trump tells them to do it, they'll do it. So that's who you really need to convince.
Well, I'm on board with that. I'm on board with that right now. You know, because I get it. You don't want to take on a case that you might not win, but why do you have to take on a case that you are 100% to the point that you're sure to the level of 100% that you're going to win? Why don't you take on the 75% case? We feel good about 75% of this is worthy of the fight. We're going to go fight and then go freaking fight.
Well, you know, I would agree with you, right? So if you rounded up some, you know, some savvy plaintiff's attorneys, right? They're gamblers. They're willing to take a gamble on a case where they, you know, the payoff could be big, but they're gamblers. DOJ are political appointees, right? The U.S. attorney, political appointee. So they've got a few, you know, it's not just a pocket that measure. It's a political, there's some political influence there and the desire to sort of, you know, stay within the party lines, toe the party line, don't make the party look bad, don't make the administration look bad. You know,
well, there is,
that would be,
there's political pressure there, but let's face it, there are career attorneys there. I mean, you know, I can famously remember an attorney that I encountered in the DOJ in 2006 who was still there in 2019. And, you know, he's a very good attorney and pretty likable guy and had gone through a whole bunch of different rounds on in the antitrust division. But I mean, you know, he wasn't a political animal. There were a lot of changes between 2006 and 2019. I mean, with administrations, what, 1, 2, 3, 4. I just come back to this thing that, you know, I get it, Joel. I mean, we go and we, you know, the DOJ looks at things, they get information, they see all this stuff, and yet they do nothing. You know, I guess, I mean, in this being the United States of America, I got to say, we play football every Saturday in the fall. Tomorrow, the Razorbacks take on Notre Dame. And when this plays out, everyone will know that we probably lost, but we might win. So we play the game because you just don't know. DOJ needs to have some fortitude and go after stuff. They need to do what's right. They are the entity that should be fighting what's right. And everything else be damned. They should go forward and do this. You know what the opposite of fortitude is, right?
I'm gonna let you tell me.
Glad you asked. The opposite of fortitude is cowardice.
All right.
Oh. It's cowards.
All right.
You know, yeah. I mean, you know, come on. Let's do something that's right. Now, you know, we talk a lot about the seed industry, and I'm really banging the desk pretty hard on this whole deal. But I mean, I think the DOJ needs to be active. But, you know, as we look, it's not just there. It's fertilizer. It's equipment. I mean, I saw a thing, and I wish I could quote the exact numbers, but I saw a thing, and it was on X, so I know it's true, because everything on X is true, except for what we see a couple of morons saying about IPSA, and we're not going to mention those guys' names, but they've never come close to saying anything true in their lives. But what the illustration was, and I actually think I saw it on the Kevin Van Trump report, was an illustration of equipment pricing over like the last 30 years or so, and how much a combine cost 30 years ago and how much a combine cost today. And I mean, the order of magnitude was, you know, something like $100,000, $300,000 to over $1 million, $1.5 million. Inflation doesn't account for that level of change. Technology doesn't account for that level of change. I mean, that's... And commodity prices are roughly the same. Yields are somewhat higher. How do we expect our agriculture to continue to produce and farmers to continue to thrive faced with that level of cost input change when the underlying commodities don't? I mean, everybody benefits from low-cost food and low-cost food inputs. How is it that we are in this situation where we just, you know, say good luck to the farmers and that's it, and allow these costs to be what they are today? I mean, it's not economically rational.
I absolutely agree with that. You know, there's something to be said for, you know, the level of market power of the major suppliers of inputs. And I think I've seen this comparison more than once, that the level of market power and consolidation that's present today is greater, or at least equal to, what it was when the antitrust laws were originally passed. Look, for example, like Packers and Stockyards is actually a pretty good one, because there were more Packers when the Packers and Stockyards Act was passed than there are currently. There's more consolidation in the protein sector than there is than there was in, I think it was 1921 when that act was passed. You know, obviously, you know, there was the wisdom to say, you know, we think that there's some imbalance here and legislation needs to come in and sort of bring some balance back, bring some parity and equity back into the the producers that participate in this market, yet for whatever reason, despite the fact you can look at the data, and I think you can see that the market power is just as great, we're not taking any action. And that's bothersome on a lot of levels. I mean, the argument I think is made, well, the only thing that matters is it beneficial to consumers? I'm like, well, yeah, that's a pretty important perspective, but it's not the only consideration. And this may, whether you agree with her or not, Lisa Kahn at the FTC started to raise some of the other issues that were worthy of consideration when it comes to antitrust and competition in the U.S.
She did. And I got to tell you that is one person that I wish that the Trump administration had held over. She really seemed to have a really strong viewpoint. And I think a good viewpoint overall with regards to where she was standing and the question she was bringing up on FTC. It would have been a good position to have a bridge to continue those type of discussions and thoughts from one administration to the other. But alas, that's not really in the repertoire of today's politics. Let's clean house and get our own people in and start over from scratch, which is always more difficult.
Right. The fellow that has taken her position, as I recall, now I haven't followed him to any large degree, but he had some similar viewpoints. Now, I don't know how similar they were, and I haven't, like I said, I don't know what he's been doing in the interim, but he did, I believe, have some viewpoints that were, competition in the marketplace is a noteworthy thing to pursue. Not solely is this going to be beneficial to consumers. A lot of things can be beneficial to consumers, one of which I would suggest is robust competition. You only have robust competition if you have a lot of market players, and we don't have that. And it depends on what market you're talking about, but if you're talking about the input suppliers, that's a oligopoly, right? It's a very few. I think it's an oligopoly. Maybe it's I'm going to probably butcher that term, but anyway.
Ogopoly.
Yeah. Well, there's ogopoly, and I think there's ogopsony. There's an opoply and an obsony, and
There are only two people on this call that probably understand Latin, and I'm not one of those two. But Catherine also knows Latin.
Oligopoly, a state of limited competition in which a market is shared by a small number of producers or sellers. Also, I looked up the prices of combines over the past 30 years. 30 years ago, high end, just to put some numbers to it, supposedly, high end combine would cost roughly $100,000 to $112,000. Today, a new top tier combine could sell for over $500,000, and some reported to have been priced over $1 million.
Oh yeah, that's the one that has the auto steer feature. It's just and it drive itself and all the and all the cool things. I get a kick out of especially at harvest, farmers in the cab of their combines, and taking a picture of how they're looking out. Look, I never drove a combine, but I drove a tractor a lot of years. Started out with no cab, then I remember we got upgraded and I had an air condition and a tape deck. Wow, that was the thing. Oh yeah, because you could just drive it, and there's nothing but big screen, and you're just. And today, if you're looking out of some of these combines, screen, screen, screen. I mean, you can't even see out the windshield because of all the screens surrounding you. It's unbelievable what they, where they're going with that. But to that point, again, huge increase in the cost of combines, and yet we still sit here with corn at $4. If our average yields had gone from 150 bushels, and I know that's really low, and our good friends in, really strong corn states like Illinois, Iowa, Indiana, and I feel like I need to name five others so I don't get rocks thrown at me, would say, oh, our yields are much higher than that. Yeah, okay. So I'm, as an illustration, 200 bushels. If we'd gone from 200 bushels to 600 bushels and corn was at $4, you know what? Maybe we could justify that. We have not seen that level of step change. We've not seen that level of step change to have this technology cost like this. And, you know, even when we look at, and, you know, I'm a big fan of history, and I continually believe that part of our detriment in the situations that we find ourselves in today are because we don't know, we don't look, we don't care about historical fact. But I mean, you know, we look at this combine today in 2025, gotta tell you, in 1945, okay, 80 years ago, that seems like a lot, but you know, World War II, you know, my dad was a man in 1945. I mean, I start looking at those kind of situations and it doesn't seem that far away from me. And what was the predominant tool on the farm in 1945? The majority of farms in the United States. Hint, it wasn't the tractor. It was real horsepower. It was a freaking horse. So you think about that. We look at, you know, where we have come in that period of time. Well, got to tell you, you got horses out there and then you buy your first farm all and, you know, that kind of situation. The order of magnitude on cost could not have been what it is today. So we've gotten out of kilter in what in the entire input sector. And I don't know. I mean, honestly, it is such a massive issue at this point. And competition is such a multifaceted issue. I don't know where we go because there has been, I mean, let's face it, consolidation in the United States, bigger is better, has always been the mantra for the life, as long as I've been an adult. And, you know, since I can equally pick on everybody everywhere and probably will have no friends when I come out of this podcast, I sit in Fayetteville, Arkansas. 20 miles up the road is the largest retailer on the planet, Walmart. And my son-in-law works for Walmart. We love Walmart. But here's the reality. Walmart constantly is accused of stifling competition. Why? Huge store, low prices, goes into a town historically. What goes out? Hardware store, mom and pop, you know, grocery, mom and pop pharmacy, all the local, you know, things that make a small town what it is, the independents that, you know, thrive there, that goes away because Walmart came in and Walmart killed the competition from everyday low prices. Is the consumer better off? Well, the consumer sees low prices in this particular case. But is our economy better off? I don't know. You know, when you start replacing independents that are making a living, that are hiring people, and, you know, what you get back out of that is minimum wage workers and everything, I'm not sure that's a great trade. But it is where we are. And Walmart is just, you know, the tip of the example there in saying that. And then when we look at how ag consolidation has happened in the chemical industry and the seed industry and equipment and fertilizer, I mean, and then you look everywhere else, as everyone knows, I'm in the restaurant business because my wife was able to seduce me into some crazy idea because I've never been able to say no to women in my life. But when I look at that and I look at the competition that as a local independent restaurant faces as well, I mean, we have gigantic competition from companies like Ruth's Chris. It's a national chain and, you know, Premier Hospitality that owns 20 Ruth's Chris. And they don't have to act economically rational. They can open up the largest Ruth's Chris on the planet right behind where we are. And it's like, well, okay, there it is. And so, I mean, we face it not only in ag, we face it everywhere. And now we're to the point that really, what can we do about it? How do we unravel this massive machine that we have created across all of our industries, I guess in the name of efficiency, money, profit, whatever, how do we unravel that at this juncture and roll it back? I got to be honest with you, I don't know that that's even possible.
You know, I would say there's agree or disagree, but I think farm policy, at least in the ag sector, I think farm policy has had a role in the consolidation over the last several decades. You know, our farm policy has been largely the same for, frankly, as long as I can remember. It hasn't really changed that dramatically. And it's really targeted at, you know, kind of a handful of commodities, not all of them, but a handful. And I don't know that I've ever seen this study, but, you know, we support agriculture at the farm level. And I think that's certainly a worthwhile and noble cause. I think something we should do, but should we do it the exact same way that we've done it essentially since the 70s? And I bring that up for this reason. At the farm level, consolidation has happened as well. There's fewer and fewer and fewer farms, and to a large degree, those farms are bigger. And the payments, the support that we provide, I'm not sure it stays at the farm. And that I think it ends up maybe going back to the input providers, right? How would, you know, if your customer base can't afford to buy your products, typically they would go down, right? But they can because we continue to support it. So those dollars, I think that, you know, I'm not sure this is true or not. I just have a suspicion that our support dollars that we want to use to support farm level producers actually wind up in shareholders' pockets.
No, I think that's probably, I think that's right. I mean, to roll that out, really and truly, we're going to sit here, and I think there's a lot of indication, a lot of discussion that one of the answers is we've got to get some money into farmers' pockets. And one of the things that we get, the ways to do that in, you know, this is going to end up being decided by the courts, is the, you know, what happens with the tariff money. Target the tariff money, because there is a massive amount of tariff money that's been collected, and we can argue about who actually paid that tariff and who didn't. But regardless, there is a massive amount of tariff money that has been collected. So what ends up happening? Can we use that for the farmers? If we can, that's great. We're going to pay the farmers, but they're not going to put that money in their pocket. They're going to pay their bills.
They're going to buy more inputs.
They're going to buy more inputs.
I mean, in a way, in a sort of a odd way, you know, the aid that we would send to the farm is going to end up, you know, bailout for the major input suppliers, because they go in, they pay off their operating note, renew it, so they can buy more inputs at these fairly elevated prices. And that just, there's a disconnect there. You know,
we're perpetuating the system. We are perpetuating the system.
Yeah. There's a really fascinating, if you want to look at it, there's actually a fascinating article in the Wall Street Journal. It came out on September 1st. And the title is "Corn and Soybeans Rule the American Farm: Why That's a Growing Problem in Charts." And, you know, it's a pretty cool article. It points out some facts, right? We are actually farming fewer acres, but the crops, you know, the yields have gone up. So we actually produce more on fewer acres. And at some point, that metric is going to cause some problems in the marketplace when you have, you know, when you just keep increasing supply and not increasing buyers and demand, there's going to be a problem. You're gonna hit a cliff at some point. It's a really good article. I would encourage you to read it.
I have seen it, and I think I glanced at it, but I will say that I don't think I read the entire thing. But I do have my Wall Street Journal subscription, so I will go back and do that again. I'm not sure we're coming up with a solution. We certainly have identified the problem, and we could sit here and lament this for another hour at least or more. I think now the challenge that we've got to come up with is, you know, how do we move forward? How do we help the, you know, USDA at what they're looking at, understand some of the dynamics and how they affect not only, you know, our independent seed companies, but also how it affects farmers in general. I think the other piece that comes into play here, though, is, you know, it'll come back, and Joel, I'm going to say it's always fun to have you on so we can, you know, talk about this stuff, but we're going to have to come back and talk about patents. I'm very passionate about patents. It's very technical. course, if I was president for a day, I'd fix all this stuff.
You could do all that in a day?
Well, you know.
I'd want to be king. I'd rather be king. If you're president.
King, president. Isn't it the same thing these days? I mean, really.
Well, they have started to converge a little bit, no doubt.
Okay, so if I was lord of the land for the day, which
there you go, there you go.
Actually, let's say 2 days, because if I was lord of the land for a day, I could fix all the problems, but I'd want to continue to be lord of the land for the night for the party that I would have, because it would be massive and everybody would want to be at it. And then, you know, just be lord of the day probably till noon the next day to get over the hangover. It, you know, but I mean, I'd like to say there are easy solutions on this, but I mean, honest to gosh, let's face it, the patent laws being what they are. I support innovation in a very big way. I believe that once you come up with an original innovation, you should have time to make money off of that. That is the American way. And that's 20 years. Beyond that, I really think that that's enough. Somebody else needs to have an opportunity to make innovation. And having overlapping patents a lot of times gets in the way. So, I mean, that's a topic for another day. Hopefully we can draft you to come back and talk with us about that. We might even find some really interesting person, a former government person that could come on and share his opinions as well. That could be really cool. I guess we'll wrap. We don't have a solution or a fix. We just have a problem and, you know, we can keep fussing about it. But I am glad to see that there's attention currently on the competition issue and on the input cost issue. I mean, there's no question it is very, very difficult at this point. So, Joel, thanks as always.
All right. Thank you. Appreciate it. It's fine.
It's my turn to do the thing now.
I was just going to say, Catherine, it's good to see you.
Yeah, good to see you too.
Arkansas versus Notre Dame. The line is Notre Dame by 4.5, last I saw. And I got to tell you, that's crazy ridiculous. I cannot see
only 4.5.
Yeah. Can't see it being that close. Although I will say this. The total Arkansas thing to do after fumbling away the last two games in the last minutes, literally, having a chance to win and fumbling them away, the total Arkansas thing to do would be to beat them by 3 touchdowns. That would totally be Arkansas.
That'd be pretty cool.
Yeah. I'm not holding that out. I got to tell you, touchdown Jesus, not going to let that happen. It's the Catholics. They're not going to let that happen. I do have to tell one story before we end. It has been said many times by me and others. God hates the Razorbacks. And I truly believe this is correct. God hates the Razorbacks. And we got touchdown Jesus coming to the stadium. Our opportunity to win this game is not good because the good Lord is just not going to be on our side. Many people don't understand why God hates the Razorbacks. And I'm going to tell you why. Because there was one incident in the past of Razorback history that is responsible for this current debacle we're in with the Lord. 1969, Arkansas and Texas, game of the century. It was a cool game. There's a book written about it. President Nixon came to Fayetteville, Arkansas for that football game. President Nixon. Arkansas ultimately lost 16-14, but President Nixon was here. It was the last game that the fight song Dixie was ever played on the University of Arkansas campus as the fight song. Arkansas changed the fight song in 1970. It was no longer Dixie. It was the last game of two, no kidding, all-white football teams to be played in the United States because the next year, football was completely integrated across the country. Lots of really cool stuff. None of that has anything to do with the fact that the good Lord didn't love the Razorbacks. Here was the deal. Our great coach and a great man that I tremendously respect, died back in 2017. Frank Broyles, who was coach and athletic director at Arkansas for over 50 years. Frank Broyles and Daryl Royal, who was the coach of Texas, were great friends, even though they were great rivals. 60s was a great rivalry year for a decade for the Arkansas versus Texas. Frank had a dinner at his house for Daryl Royal and his wife. Frank and his wife and a really good friend of Frank Broyles named Billy Graham, because Billy Graham also was at the Arkansas-Texas game. And back then, he gave an invocation before the game. So Billy Graham, Frank Broyles, and Darryl Royal at Frank's house, right up the road from me. What happened? Billy brought his young son, Franklin Graham, with him. Frank Broyles' dog bit Franklin Graham. God hates the Razorbacks. That dog, Frank Broyles' dog, ruined it for us. I mean, it's been 6 decades. And we are still not in good graces of the Lord. I don't know how we're going to make it up. One day we'll be redeemed and forgiven. And look out, world. The Hogs are going to win the national championship year after year. But for now, we suck. There you are. God Hates the Razorbacks, 1969. You heard it here on Stock Talk. Frank Broyles' dog bit Franklin Graham, and that was it.
In other news, don't forget to like, subscribe, and share so everyone else can hear how God hates the Razorbacks because of a dog.
There you go. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, Joel.
All right. Thanks a lot.